right back where I belong. Ladies and gentlemen, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I heard this in every single day of the work week from 6 till 9. And then we run highlights of the previous day from 5 a.m. for you early risers. Welcome to the radio program of record for this 13th day of August. And the Olympics are over.
Yeah, and I also saw you grab a book there. It said something about take a trip or cash, and you put it away in a drawer, just throw it in the garbage. Are we done with that, too?
We are finished with that content.
Okay.
For some reason, we stopped doing the take the trip, keep the cash contest, and the Olympics wrap-up,
right?
And the Olympics got all the attention.
Right.
That it was the end of the Olympics. Kind of overshadowed the fact that it was the last day of the contest.
Right. Okay. So we got that.
Last day was last Friday.
Yes. So they had all weekend to publicize the fact that it was over.
Contest went fast and the Olympics went fast. Wow.
Oh, and you know, we are beginning to find out how Kamala Harris is going to define herself as a candidate. She's going to take all of Donald Trump's positions. Here is what I'm talking about. This is Donald Trump in June of 2024, okay? This is him in June in Vegas.
Because when I get to office, we are going to not charge taxes on tips, people making tips.
Okay. Here's Kamala Harris. 3 days ago.
Eliminate taxes on tips for service and hospitality workers.
Okay, well, first of all, it's of course it's a ripoff, but it tells us that the Harris people know. The people behind Kamala Harris's campaign, they know what the issues in this campaign are, and they know who the voters are that will decide this election.
Hospitality workers.
People like hospitality workers.
Hospitality workers.
Again, she is 2 months late on this one.
Because when I get to office, we are going to not charge taxes on tips, people making tips.
Eliminate taxes on tips for service and hospitality workers.
Okay. I praised Trump when he came out with this idea. You know, they didn't used to tax tips until the 80s. And Trump he tells a very interesting story. He said the genesis of the idea for him was a conversation he had with a waitress. And they were talking about the economy, and one of the things she mentioned is, yeah, you know, but every time we get a nice tip, but it's just treated as taxable wages. And Trump thought about it and called for an end to taxing the tips of people who make their living in professions where you get a substantial amount of your income from tips. I call it a tax cut for the working class. I love the idea. And the federal treasury doesn't get hardly any, I mean, in terms of revenue to the federal treasury, they don't get that much from it. It, in other words, means a whole lot more to the people who have the job than it does to the federal government. Disproportionately has a huge impact. So I thought that was revealing. Now, what will be even more revealing is, will the rest of the media point this out? Will the rest of the media point out that she's plagiarized one of Donald Trump's centerpiece economic ideas? I am guessing the media will not. For when I say media, I mean corporate media, the formerly known as the mainstream media, which is now exposed as not being mainstream at all, and not, frankly, oftentimes engaging in what we used to call journalism. And basically, they're reporting news in a way to help one side, i.e. their side. So they will play this down. They will not point this out, which is why that's what Donald Trump and his campaign have to do. And make this the focus of their campaign, that she's a radical, that she's trying to hide her positions. Have you seen the rest of the media point out how she has changed her position on major issues? And I'm not talking about an issue that she voted once for when she was during her short stint in the Senate. I'm talking she was sponsoring and co-sponsoring major pieces of legislation. For instance, to do away with private health insurance and have America adopt single payer. I'm talking about her radical positions, the Biden administration's positions on the border, which amounted to a complete reversal of the Trump positions, were her positions when she was a candidate for president in 2020. Now she's backing away from those positions as well. Another huge issue to the climate community, especially the climate change activists, is, and this is almost like an article of faith, you must oppose fracking. You must oppose hydraulic fracturing, which has basically given birth to the natural gas industry, which ironically has helped reduce America's carbon footprint because the transition from coal in the direction of natural gas has resulted in less carbon output. She was against fracking. It's on tape. We've played that tape several times, so have other media outlets. And yet the media are soft-pedaling that. So there are three major positions that she was out in front of, and the media so far have been very bashful about pointing this out. Again, that is why Trump, the Trump world needs to do it. An interesting take on this is Hugh Hewitt, who used to be on NBC and now is on Fox, summed up some of her reversals in a conversation he had yesterday on Fox News with Brett Baer.
Hugh, let me start with you. What about this flip-flopping attack? Obviously, we've played many iterations on different topics, and there really hasn't been the opportunity to have a sit-down formal interview with Kamala Harris or a press conference, for that matter.
22 days and counting. I think she has read Harry Potter and about the cloak of invisibility, and it worked for them, so she's put on the cloak of invisibility. Yeah, when you talked to Congressman Goldman earlier, he said an astonishing thing. Kamala Harris has to, quote, decide where she wants to be. That was his excuse for her not appearing before any kind of live press event or giving any kind of in-depth interview. I think that's actually true. She's trying to figure out what she wants to say to win, and she has to unsay everything she said in 2019 and 2020, especially on the border, Brett.
See, that's it exactly. She has to unsay everything that she has previously said. The less defined she is by the issues that she used to define herself when she was running in the Democrat primaries in 2020 and was trying to highlight her liberalism, are things that now cost her votes. And, you know, it's interesting. Here we are 22 days in. You would think the media would be in almost a mutinous frame of mind about a candidate for president who has not sat down for an interview or held a press conference in 22 days. She's received all this adulatory media coverage, almost completely uncritical, while they've been piling on more criticism of Donald Trump, who, by the way, had a very fascinating conversation yesterday with Elon Musk. We'll talk about that a little later on the show. But what's interesting is we're less than 85 days out from the election, right? And if you look at the polls in the top seven swing states, I would have expected that Kamala Harris would be ahead by a healthy margin in all of them. And the reason why is, number one, the Democrats were disjointed, dejected, disillusioned with Joe Biden as their nominee. They knew they were sleepwalking toward defeat. So at least when Kamala Harris, they decided to coalesce around Kamala, they thought, maybe we can win this after all. And there's this burst of short-term euphoria. Okay, you would think that that would make her much more popular. You'd think that she's uniting the Democratic Party. You notice that nobody stepped up to try and snatch the mantle from her. They never even got that far. So she's got a completely united party with a burst of energy behind it. You think that would raise the enthusiasm level among women voters, among young voters, maybe get Black and Hispanic voters moving back toward the Democrats. They've been starting to head toward Trump. And yet in five of the seven states, the swing states that will really decide this election, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Georgia, North Carolina, and Nevada, in five of those seven states, Trump is still ahead. He is still ahead. And this is when his campaign was, you know, let's be candid, was kind of knocked off stride. They were expecting to be running against Biden. Instead, it's Kamala. And then this massive explosion of support for her and unity. And so the Trump campaign had to regroup and retool. We got a different opponent now. It's been criticized for not anticipating this could happen and having Plan B ready to go. But bottom line is they were thrown off stride for a couple of weeks. So she's basically had free running field, open field running here for 2-3 weeks. And yet in Arizona, she's down. Trump up 48.3 to Harris 46.8. In Wisconsin, she is ahead of Trump by less than 1 point. In Michigan, she's actually ahead of him by over 2 points, 48.7 to 46.3. But in Pennsylvania, Trump is up by almost a point. In Georgia, Trump is up by about a little over half a point. In North Carolina, he's up by 3 points. In Nevada, he's up by almost 4 points. And this is when it's as good as it's going to get for Kamala Harris. And when the Trump campaign has admittedly not run as effectively the last couple weeks as it has been doing for the past several months. So this is most interesting. That this is explaining why she is now trying not only to walk back her positions on issues that are well documented, but why she's now trying to purloin, there's a word you haven't heard in a little while, for steal, purloin, the Trump playbook on appealing to working class wage earners.
I have just come across a social media post that has two different versions of the same story as presented by CBS News. And wait till you hear how it's reflected for Kamala Harris versus how it was reflected when Trump suggested this idea of do not tax.
I think
tips.
I know where you're going, and I'm...
It's pretty egregious.
Yes, but...
It's really egregious. What am I talking about? It's very egregious as media bias goes, but we'll get to that in the next segment.
Which is what we call a tease in radio, the social media sweep right around the corner. The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. It is 19 and a half minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning. Great to be back. Good morning. The song is called I'm Glad.
Because you're back.
The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. It is 25 minutes after 6 o'clock this Tuesday morning. That means Philip J. Vandervoort III standing by with the social media sweep. Go for it, Philip J.
Thank you. I want to start this off with a little bit of a confession. I'd like to acknowledge the daily job assistance that I'm receiving from whoever it is that is the social media director for the Associated Press, because whoever that is that's posting tweets for the Associated Press, they are just feeding me batting practice pitches that I am just crushing over the fence every day.
Oh yeah,
here on the show. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. And I got a hat tip to the Associated Press social media director because they've done it again. I pointed out three different ones last week. Here's the latest example. And this one is from the @AP Associated Press. And the story tease says, on the campaign trail, Kamala Harris is pushing joy while Trump paints a darker picture. And just on the face of what I just read you, if I could pay my grocery bills with joy, I would be fine with that.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I'm not able to pay my grocery bills or my utility bills or my insurance bills with joy. So pardon me if I'm a little bit skeptical about this portrayal of the two campaigns between one Kamala Harris and Donald Trump.
Here's the thing. The reason she's so joyful is that she can pay her grocery bill. She doesn't have to worry about transportation. Yeah. That's all handled.
Yeah.
She gets a ride. You know, I mean, everything she needs to worry about, economically speaking, is pretty much taken care of. Oh, plus she's married to a mega millionaire.
So thanks a lot, Associated Press. I'll be asking the cashier if joy is an acceptable form of payment at the grocery store. And when they go, huh? Yes. I'll go, never mind.
Cash, credit card, or joy?
Now, you were just talking this last segment about Kamala Harris co-opting what Trump has been saying for the last couple of months between June and July on the campaign trail, that he suggests no longer taxing tips for service industry workers, waiters, waitresses, servers, bussers, bartenders, people that rely on tips. And Kamala Harris pulls it off and everyone's like, hey, this sounds like a great idea, right? So here's an example that a congressman from Texas, Wesley Hunt, has put together. Wesley Hunt's social media profile says Army veteran, West Point graduate, native Texan, congressman for the 38th district in Texas. And he apparently flew Apache pilot. He was an Apache pilot in the Army. So that was one of the things that he did in the Army. And he has a screen grab of a CBS News tweet from June. And let me double check the date here. June 17th, 2024.
Okay, that's right after Trump came out in favor of not taxing the tips.
And the CBS News post says, former President Donald Trump's vow to stop taxing tips would cost the federal government up to $250 billion over 10 years, according to a nonpartisan watchdog group. And then over the weekend, Kamala Harris in Las Vegas, and there's a screen grab of her at the podium in her lavender purple suit coat speaking in Las Vegas. And it says, Vice President Kamala Harris is rolling out a new policy position saying she'll fight to end taxes on tips for service and hospitality workers. But there's no mention of how this would cost the federal government $250 billion over 10 years like they did when Trump did this or suggested this.
The same Twitter feed.
Yeah.
Same Twitter feed from CBS.
CBS News.
Points out Trump is just called for not taxing tips. It's going to cost the Treasury money.
It's going to take away money from the federal government.
Kamala Harris
cannot do that.
Does it, and all
no
they
mention
do
whatsoever.
No mention of the Treasury. No mention that she stole the idea.
And bless this congressman. He points out what an honest media we have. Same policy, different candidates, and the drastically different presentation for how this is connected to the individual candidates. Man, I hate to tell you, we told you so, but we've been telling you so.
By the way, J.D. Vance, since we're doing social media, said, I enjoyed sitting down with the three major networks today to answer the tough questions any leader should answer. Kamala Harris has done as many tough interviews as Tim Walz has battlefield deployments. Ouch. All right, it is coming up here on 6:30, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 57 now to 7 o'clock in the morning, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. I don't know if you had a chance to watch the Elon Musk, Donald Trump conversation yesterday. It really was more of a conversation than an interview. And because it was a more relaxed format, you actually got more out of it. And one of the things they talked about, which is particularly timely, was how Trump dealt with Vladimir Putin on the issue of Ukraine. And Trump was well aware that Putin had eyes on Ukraine, that Putin wanted Ukraine. Now, during the Obama years, he did invade eastern Ukraine to seize control of Crimea, which is a major shipping port, and which has a lot of Russian-speaking people and strong allegiances to Russia. That was his claim, that this, for all intents and purposes, is a Russian province that is stuck down there in eastern Ukraine. If these people had their choice, they would be Russian. So using that as the pretext, he invaded, and he seized and secured Crimea. And he made it clear to Trump he wanted the rest of it as well. So here is a bit of their conversation yesterday, Elon Musk and Trump talking about how he dealt with Putin.
And again, I said to Vladimir Putin, I said, don't do it. You can't do it, Vladimir. You do it, it's going to be a bad day. You cannot do it. And I told him things that what I do. And he said, no way. And I said, way. And you know, it's the last time we ever had the conversation.
I told him things we would do. He said, no way. I said, way. And it was the last time we had the conversation. Did you notice that during the Trump administration, Putin never invaded Ukraine? So he invaded Ukraine when Obama was president. He invaded Ukraine when Biden was president after that disastrous the disastrous way he withdrew from Afghanistan sent him all the signals he needed that Biden was a weakling. But the guy who is called Putin's puppet, the guy who is called Vladimir's lackey, the guy who is called a yes man for Putin, kept him from invading Ukraine simply by telling him what would happen if he did. I was on a panel recently with a number of political people. It was a panel put together by the, I don't know if you remember the McLaughlin Group, John McLaughlin, and Morton Kondracki was one of the panelists on the McLaughlin Group. Anyway, Morton is the what was the moderator of the panel, and there was a woman on who has been a foreign policy scholar and expert for decades. And she made several abrasive comments about Donald Trump being slavishly devoted to Putin's agenda, and that if Trump were president, he would sell out Ukraine in an instant. And when it was my turn to talk, instead of saying why I disagreed with her, I simply said, you've been a foreign policy expert for many years. I've always wondered why Vladimir Putin invaded Ukraine when Obama was president, invaded Ukraine when Biden was president, but never invaded Ukraine when Trump was president. How come? And there was like 4 seconds of dead air. It was a Zoom panel. And she said, well, I don't know. But there can be many reasons for that. And then she just tried to, but, you know, Vladimir Putin's aggression is well known. And, you know, she goes through this word salad. And then I said, okay, fine, but I'm wondering why, if Trump is this guy's lapdog, why didn't he take Ukraine when Trump was president? And she said, well, I don't know. And I don't know why Trump's critics, especially the foreign policy crowd, isn't pressed on this issue more often. Because the fact that when Trump said, as he said last night, when if I had been reelected, this would not have happened. Putin would never have invaded Ukraine if I had been reelected. I think Trump is right. And I bring this up because you probably have heard now that the war, despite tens of billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars in Western military and domestic aid for Ukraine, the war is not going well for them. And they have now invaded, Ukraine has now invaded Russia. They have landed in the region of Kursk, and they have secured control of several nearby villages. And it was kind of a way of shocking the Russians and giving them a win. It's not much of a win, but it's a morale builder for the Ukrainian people. But the point is, this war slogs on, and if Kamala Harris becomes the commander-in-chief of the United States government, think about that. Kamala Harris, Commander-in-Chief. What is she going to do? How is she going to bring this war to an end? Or are we just going to keep doing what we're doing, which is not producing the results that we want? If Trump was reelected, do you not think that he could try and negotiate an end to this war?
John, can you go back to the words of the Elon Musk conversation Trump had last night over Putin? Word for word, what he said, Putin said.
Yeah,
okay.
It's not a very long clip. This is Trump talking to Elon Musk last night about his negotiations with Putin about Ukraine.
And again, I said to Vladimir Putin, I say, don't do it. You can't do it, Vladimir. You do it, it's going to be a bad day. You cannot do it. And I told him things that what I do. And he said, no way. And I said, way.
Okay, stop right there. And now, no way. Response to Trump is way. Does that sound like a politician negotiating there? Or does that sound like a businessman negotiating? Big difference. And how many times during the time that Donald Trump was in the White House, we kept hearing, he's not a politician. He's just not a politician.
Yeah.
But he's a businessman, and he negotiates. That's proof right there.
No way. And I said, way.
There you go.
And, it's the last time we ever had the conversation.
And the reason it was the last time they had the conversation is they knew that Trump's words would be backed up with concrete action. Okay, he had destroyed ISIS, all but finished them. Now, believe it or not, they're making a comeback. Is that a surprise to you? He took out and killed Iran's chief architect of terror, General Qasem Soleimani. He eliminated the head of ISIS, Anwar Baghdadi. So when Trump says he's going to do something, he does follow it up with concrete action. So I know that we're thinking about the economy, and I know that we're thinking about the border, and I know that we're thinking about, just issues like crime and out of control immigration, and attempts by blue state politicians and blue city mayors and county executives to mainstream illegal immigration. And people are tired of all this. But also, let's remember, we are electing a commander-in-chief in addition to a president. And the world was a safer place under Trump because bad guys knew that there would be real-world consequences if they got out of line with Trump in the White House. What do you think they're thinking about Kamala Harris? It's 47 minutes after 6 o'clock, 12 and a half minutes to 7. Going to chat with our good buddy Lars Larson coming right up on the commute with Carlson, our noon to 3 host, checking in. Hope your morning is going well. It's 7 o'clock on the John Carlson Show, and here's my good buddy Lars Larson, our noon to 3 host. How are you, Lars?
Good morning, John. I'm doing better. Was anybody that surprised that a massive undertaking like an interview of Donald Trump by Elon Musk put those two personalities on a feed and say it was, number one, the subject of DOS attacks that helped shut it down, and number two,
tell our listeners what DOS attacks means.
Denial of service. It would be, to take it out of computers. If you had a little store, and your competition wanted to make sure you never got a call from a customer to place an order, they would have somebody or a number of people just call your store's phone number over and over and over again to the point where any potential customer you might want would get a busy signal or a jammed up line. That's the essence of what a DOS attack is in terms of social media or computers. You just plow so many inquiries in, and it basically forces anybody who wants to actually watch it out. So,
at any one time, this interview went on for over 2 hours.
Yeah.
But at any one time, there were over a million people listening. And you have to wonder how many million people listened to at least a part of it.
Right. Which is what I did, and then went back and took excerpts and looked at transcripts and things like that. Was there any real news that came out? I'm not sure you'd say there was anything new. I mean, an awful lot of the themes were familiar from Trump, but it was interesting to see those two mix it up, especially where Musk, and there are things I don't like about Musk at all. Some of the brain research and the, you know, let's put machines in your head kind of stuff. I don't like the fact that he seems to buy some of the climate change nonsense. Mm-hmm.
Far less than his fellow techies.
Right. It's still there. Yeah.
The other thing, though, is I think that he established a comfort level with Trump.
Yep.
That will make it easier for people who are on the fence to feel more comfortable supporting him. I just think the tone of their conversation was advantageous to Trump.
You know what bothered me? A Washington Post reporter during the KJP White House briefing yesterday inquired, doesn't the White House have a role in trying to shut this down? And I thought, you've got to be nuts. I'm old enough to remember when reporters would take any attempt to shut down anybody's speech as a threat to the press. They say, you can't shut that person down because you'll come for us next. And now the WAPO, Jeff Bezos' paper, wants them to shut down a conversation between Musk and Trump. No way.
Wow. It is coming up here on 4 minutes to 7 o'clock. Brian Haywood, the most consequential man in Washington state politics, joining me at 7:05. Boy, do we have a lot of things to talk about. You don't want to miss a moment of our conversation. It's right around the corner. John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. It's Tuesday morning, 13th day of August for the radio program of record. By the way, have you guys noticed that J.D. Vance, Trump's running mate, is all over the media? He's doing interviews. He doesn't lay down conditions beforehand.
When you said last hour that 22 days now for Kamala Harris, no interview per se.
Yeah.
How fast was it after Trump announced J.D. Vance as the vice president candidate? Was he on the media and giving interviews?
Oh, probably 5 minutes.
At the RNC convention, too.
Within a day or two. But that's not what I wanted to point out. I thank you for mentioning it and reaffirming that it's been 22 days. She still hasn't had an interview. She still hasn't done a press conference. Her running mates disappeared now, too. He wasn't. Did you notice the Sunday show? He wasn't anywhere. So he's kind of laying low. Can you have both candidates in the basement until November? Anyway, we'll find it. I've got a couple of reasons why I think that now he's laying low. Now the campaign is telling him to stay out of the public eye unless it's a very, very scripted, choreographed appearance. But I don't want to get into national issues right now. We'll do that in about a half hour. What I want to get into is, you know, this happened after we were off the air on Friday. One of the strangest legal stories that I have seen in all my years at the crossroads of media and politics. That Bob Ferguson, the attorney general, was secretly supervising two lawsuits that were both filed for the purpose of denying the public a chance to vote on the four initiatives that are going to be on your November ballot. The initiative to allow you to choose natural gas if you so choose, rather than have the government make that choice for you. The initiative to strike down the capital gains tax, the income tax on investments. The initiative to strike down the mandatory payroll tax for long-term care and make that program voluntary. And, of course, the big one, 2117, the initiative that strikes down the Climate Commitment Act's carbon tax on gasoline that has raised the price of gas 43 cents a gallon. There were two lawsuits filed to prevent you from even being allowed to vote on them. What kind of people would file lawsuits like that? Why? The kind of people who say they're trying to save democracy by denying you a chance to vote on it. But what was really bizarre is that Bob Ferguson's office did not inform the public. Bob Ferguson's office never sent out a press release or otherwise informed the news media. And most particularly, Bob Ferguson's office never even told the organization responsible for those initiatives, Let's Go Washington, Brian Haywood's organization, about these lawsuits. He deliberately excluded Let's Go Washington from being told about this. The lawsuits were filed. They were challenging the decades-long policy process for verifying signatures for initiatives. Anyway, Brian Haywood is with us this morning. We got to talk about this and several other things, so let's get right to it. Brian, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Alive. And still fighting.
Of course. When I heard about this, I was actually on a long weekend a trip to see my son. I'm going through this, and I went, what? What? I was following Brandi Cruz's commentary on this. I said, this is just bizarre. What is going on? And you said you didn't find out until a reporter called you to say, by the way, the Supreme Court's ruling on this in a couple hours. Did you have comment?
Exactly. Jerry Kornfield was fortunately following the Supreme Court docket and called us up and said, hey, what do you guys know about this? And this was about 2 o'clock on a Friday that I first heard about it. And when I found out about it, it was 2 hours before the Supreme Court was set to rule. So we were 2 hours away from possibly getting all four of them suddenly overturned without any notice. And I think the shocking thing is that this had been going on. The first lawsuit was filed in January, and then it was rejected at the Superior Court in Thurston in April. So there had been a back and forth and a back and forth, but there was, as far as I can tell, not an open hearing of things. It was mostly exchange of documents.
Sure.
And then it should have gone in April. I guess they should have appealed it, but they waited 3 months until the 2066 had been certified. And then along with a second lawsuit, they filed an appeal and asked for expedited treatment at the Supreme Court. But they had waited 3 months. But they said, oh, we don't have time because we need to get this before it goes on the ballot. So there were dirty things all over on the plaintiff side. And this was Nick Hanauer's group, Defend WA and Civic Ventures and SEIU and WEA, so the teachers union bosses and the labor, so the state employee union bosses.
The people largely responsible for how dysfunctional so much of Washington state government is and how poorly they produce the, for instance, of the teachers unions, a more educated workforce. For heaven's sakes, they're in the way of a more educated workforce oftentimes. But what struck me is Bob Ferguson, when this is brought up that he was concealing this, he gets self-righteous and says, these are all public documents. All you had to do is check the morning court docket. Who the hell checks the morning court docket?
Well, apparently in the state, that's a scary thing. If he were to heaven forbid, become governor. Can you imagine? That's the morning. Your morning routine has to now be make sure you check the court docket so that you're not getting sued. And as much as he likes to sue, everybody's at risk with that.
Well, it just, again, one more time, what a slimy lawyer. He says, oh, we gave the public notice. It's in the court docket. All you have to do is check the docket, as if people go out of their way to do something like that. Jerry Kornfield did, again, hours before the court ruled, because that is his job as a reporter. And he's a good one, by the way. But this isn't what most people do. And, of course, Ferguson knows it full well. He was doing the minimal, the bare minimal amount of public disclosure. What's been the reaction to this, Brian?
Overwhelmingly, it's been sort of outrage and disbelief that it's happened. It's like sort of suddenly the phones of our staff and the organization itself have been off the hook. All the comments have been, what is going on? I think there's a belief and a disbelief at the same time. People believe that he would do that, but a disbelief that it actually happened.
Yeah.
This is a guy who has a press release if the sun comes up. And for 6 months, the back and forth.
There we go.
He never said anything. He never. And I even in the arguments, this is one of the more interesting things. In the to the credit of the Attorney General's office, they had to defend this, and they defended it, and we prevailed. But we were completely reliant on them, not knowing that we were reliant on them. We had no chance to put any input in. The Attorney General himself is conflicted because he's publicly stated that he's opposed to the initiatives, and the people filing the initiatives are all donors to his campaign.
Mm-hmm.
There's huge, huge conflict. It seems to me that an honest, upright, ethical approach to this, when you've got those conflicts, would be to hold a press conference and say, look, this is what's going on. This is how we're going to handle it. We want to make sure that everybody knows.
Yeah.
And in their filings, in the filings of the Attorney General's office, they noted that Defend WA had failed to notify Let's Go Washington or me. And both of our names were specifically cited in their documents. And that's an unethical process. And they called it out, yet they didn't feel the need to let us know. And I'll tell you, it seems to me that they were playing a little game of heads I win, tails I win. If the Supreme Court had ruled the other way, they would say, well, we tried. And if it ruled the way that it did, they could say, oh, see, we defended democracy. We're out there. We're the champions.
Yeah.
You should believe in us.
Yeah.
And they didn't lose either way. But we and the voters had a huge, huge risk sitting there with nine justices.
By the way, it shows how weak their case is again, the state Supreme Court unanimously swept aside their challenge. Unanimously swept aside their challenge. It was that weak. But what a sneaky, again, what goes to show is whatever will gain us power or keep our power, we're willing to do. In this case, try and drive all these initiatives off the ballot and do it as quietly as possible. There is going to be I love how you put this, Brian, a press conference that the Attorney General should have held, but it's going to be held by Let's Go Washington on Wednesday, this Wednesday at 3:00 in the afternoon. Tell us more.
Well, it's been interesting. There's been very little, let's call it the mainstream or the old school media coverage on this at all. It's been you and Ari and Jason and Brandy have been covering it. Jerry Kornfield found it, but there hasn't been much in the mainstream media. And I don't think this is something that you sweep under the rug. So we want to let people know this happened. Your rights were very close. Your right to vote on these issues was very close to being wiped out without any notification. And even we'd like the press to be there, but even if they don't, we're going to rally supporters in front of the Attorney General's office to make the point that this is not acceptable, that you keep this thing secret like this.
Now, this is in his Seattle office downtown on 800 Fifth Avenue, correct?
That's correct, at 3 p.m.
3 p.m. On the Wednesday, 3 p.m. this Wednesday, downtown Seattle, the office of the Attorney General, 800 Fifth Avenue. That's away from most of the stuff you don't want to see about Seattle. It's several blocks away from the blight, if you will. But anyway, we're going to tell you more about this rally coming up here on The Commute. But it's Rally for Democracy on Wednesday, tomorrow. Yikes, tomorrow. It's going to be on 800 Fifth Avenue right in front of his office. All right, while we're talking about events, Brian, Freedom Fest, give us an update this Saturday.
I think the exciting thing to me is that we've got some really good food trucks that are going to be there. We've got some barbecue.
Yes.
But we're starting at 4:30. We'll go to about 8:30. This is open to everybody. It's not a partisan event. This is not a Republican event. This is a celebration of freedom. We welcome any of our friends out there who may be of any different political stripe. We really want to celebrate the sort of momentous achievement of all these people signing these initiatives
yes.
to take back some of the control that seems to have been swept out through Olympia. But it's really going to, it's not going to be a lot of having to eat your vegetables. We're hoping there's quite a bit of dessert there where you can come and enjoy it, bring your family. We'll have some things for kids. We'll have a band that's playing. We'll have a little bit of vegetables with some speeches from people. But mostly it's going to be get out there and enjoy freedom with other people that feel the same as you do.
Here's the bottom line, folks. It's a party. It's a party, exactly. And you're invited, and it's free. Summer Freedom Fest, it's going to be this Saturday. I am one of the MCs. Brandy Cruz is going to be one of the MCs. There's going to be live music. There's going to be a play area for the kids with bouncy houses, the inflatables, the kind of things kids love to play on all the time. There's going to be the food trucks that Brian mentioned, dozens of vendor booths, major political figures for you to not just listen to, but actually talk to. They're going to be hanging out, meeting, greeting, walking around. And if you have not registered to vote, you can register to vote there as well. All of this is happening this Saturday from 4:30 to 8:30. Again, 4:30 in the afternoon till 8:30. At Willowcrest Stables and Farm. That's Brian's spread out in Redmond. For more information, just go to letsgowashington.com. That's letsgowashington.com. And click the events tab. All the information you want is right there. Brian, looking forward to getting an update from you. Maybe as soon as tomorrow, certainly no later than Thursday. It's a very busy news week, isn't it?
It's so much happening, but I think the right prevails, and we're still fighting. So
absolutely,
you covering it.
You got it. It is 20 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning. The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J. right around the corner of the social media suite, like a song about our listeners. Anyway, by the way, radio legend Mark Christopher does not tell me what songs are playing coming
right.
back
Mark,
from Bay.
Mark picks them, and they come up so, when they come up. Are
even last
ready?
Minute, just here. A feel of looking outside, John's back, that came to mind.
So let me guess, mm-hmm. Andy Kim. Is that the artist?
I think he did a version of it. Gallery.
Oh, Gallery.
Nice okay. to be with you.
All right. Very good. All right, nice to be with you, Philip J. Vandervoort III. Tell us what's going on in the social media world.
I think the most significant primary election result for Washington State got an update on that. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. This is for Public Lands Commissioner. It's been a little bit dramatic. It started off with two Republicans in the top two positions, and then gradually, slowly, and then all at once, the third place finisher, Dave Upthegrove, a King County Democrat on the King County Council, has surged from third place into second place and appears to be poised to advance to the general election against the leading finisher in the primary, Republican Jamie Herrera Butler. She's a former state lawmaker and then a former U.S. Congresswoman from Southwest Washington in the 3rd District for U.S. Congress. So here's a little bit of what has transpired after Friday night's election primary tabulations and then yesterday, Monday night's latest election results from the state Secretary of State office. Last Thursday night, after they did the Thursday night tabulation, Sue Cool Peterson was in second place over the third place candidate by about 2,900 votes. So she had about a 2,900 vote lead last Thursday night. Now she has gone to trailing by 5,724 votes as of last night. So over the course of Friday night's election results and last night's election results, that's about an 8,600 vote swing for the third place person to move into second place, and that's Dave Upthegrove.
In 2 more days of vote counting.
Exactly. We've got a few more votes to count.
So am I suspicious about this?
It's pretty swift comeback. A lot of ballots were coming out of King County, which is where Dave Upthegrove gets all of his political support.
Right.
So and that's what was one of the imbalances.
And that's what matters as we look at what's coming up. Sue Kuehl Peterson, Republican. Dave Upthegrove, Democrat. If Sue Kuehl Peterson wins, then you'll have two Republicans, right. Sue and Jamie Herrera Butler, in the November showdown. Dave Upthegrove flooded the airwaves with last-minute commercials. They were all over the place.
Yeah.
Okay, and so I'm not surprised that a lot of the later votes would be for Upthegrove, since that's when most of his advertising hit. Yeah. The second thing is that a lot of those votes came out of King County. So now that he's swung a 3,000-vote deficit to a 5,700-vote advantage, is it over? Not entirely. Here's reason to hope for Sue.
I like your optimism here, because I'm not as optimistic.
The Secretary of State's office says that there's about 42,000 votes left to count. 30,000 of them are in Republican-friendly counties.
Okay.
Only 3,000 ballots, according to the Secretary of State's office, only 3,000 ballots are from King County. So that's like 8% of the remaining ballots. You have, on the other hand, 4,000 votes out of Clallam County. She lives on the peninsula, Sue Kuehl Peterson.
Okay.
3,000 in Douglas County. There's Wenatchee. You've got 5,000 votes out of Spokane County.
Okay.
Or excuse me, out of Stevens County, even more conservative
up there.
You've got 9,500 out of Walla Walla.
Okay.
So it ain't quite over yet.
This is like the scene in Dumb and Dumber. So you're saying there's a chance. Now, I have one more footnote to add to this about Dave Upthegrove.
Yes.
According to the Washington State Standard.
Yes.
According to the political news website in Washington, the Washington State Standard, they went to the State Public Disclosure Commission where you have to report all your campaign contributions. Dave Upthegrove was the top fundraiser in the public lands commissioner race, grabbing $587,000. Sue Kuehl Peterson had $29,000. That is a 20 times spending advantage
20-to-1
that Upthegrove has over Sue Kuehl Peterson. So I'm going to be looking forward to when Cori Bush, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and Jamal Bowman all come out to Seattle and decry the excessive amount of spending that Dave Upthegrove had that prevented Sue Kuehl Peterson from potentially getting past the prior, getting through the primary to the general election.
Special interest group money trying to buy an election. I can't
wait. I'm sure those squad members will be out here quickly to do all that, right?
I think they're on flights as we speak. Not. Back we are. The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. It is 24 minutes to 8 o'clock. During the 6 o'clock hour, we played this wonderful back and forth of Kamala Harris over the weekend announcing a new economic policy that she believes the federal government should no longer tax the tips of people who work in the hospitality industry. Where did she get this idea? Here's Donald Trump in Las Vegas in June of 2024.
Because when I get to office, we are going to not charge taxes on tips, people making tips.
Okay. And here's Kamala, also in Vegas over the weekend.
Eliminate taxes on tips for service and hospitality workers.
Just one little problem. The Inflation Reduction Act, which passed on a 50-50 vote in the Senate when the Vice President, Kamala Harris, broke the tie, heavily subsidized the IRS and the Biden-Harris administration had the IRS use part of that cash infusion to crack down on workers not reporting their tips. So the IRS cracks down on tipped wage earners, and Kamala Harris, who enabled this to happen by breaking the 50-50 tie in the Senate on the legislation that made it happen, now says that workers shouldn't be taxed on their tips. Okay. Anyone surprised? It is 39 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning. About an hour ago, we were talking about how Kamala Harris is not taking, not doing interviews, has not had a press conference to speak of in 22 days. And even more bizarre is that now Tim Walz, her running mate, who is getting unwanted media scrutiny for two things. First, well, a whole bunch of things, but under two broad categories, misrepresenting his military record, and also his extremism. He's now disappeared from the press interview circuit. I mean, you know, J.D. Vance, his counterpart on the Republican side, is all over the place. Tim Walz being very laying low, being very, very quiet. That's because they got a problem here. They thought they were going to be able to portray Tim Walz as a Midwestern, ordinary kind of guy, you know, a guy who served his country in the military and was a football coach and didn't run for office till he was in his 40s. The problem is that when he did take office, he became far more liberal than people had expected. When he was in Congress, he, in the 2018 elections, which were a great election year for Democrats, he lucked into a congressional seat that was moderately conservative. So his voting record was moderately liberal. In other words, he was as liberal as he could get away with. When he became governor and had a Democrat legislature, well, then he could be what he really was. And what he really was every bit as liberal as Jay Inslee in Washington, Tina Kotek in Oregon, and Gavin Newsom in California. The problem being that Minnesota ain't California. So here's just the latest example. And he is having trouble defending this. In 2023, so not long ago, just last year, Tim Walz, as Minnesota governor, backed legislation that required public schools to provide tampons in restrooms, in girls' restrooms, grades 4 through 12. And also to stock tampons, pads, and other items in boys' restrooms, grades 4 through 12. The law has been in effect since January 1st. Republican legislators tried to amend the bill before it passed to limit the products I just mentioned to only being in female restrooms. They were blocked. And instead, this bill that requires restrooms used by 9-year-old boys to stock tampons, a bill to require that, is now the law of the land. This is, so you're thinking, well, was that kind of an outlier? No, it's not. That's in keeping with how this guy thinks. He signed a bill in April that made Minnesota, I mentioned this last week, a sanctuary state for child sex surgery. Again, Minnesota would be a sanctuary for child sex surgery, i.e. gender-affirming care. The supporters, not the opponents, the supporters called it the Trans Refuge Bill because it grants legal protection to children who travel to Minnesota for, quote, gender-affirming care, close quote, that includes puberty blockers, which are illegal in Great Britain. They've made puberty blockers illegal for minors in Great Britain. It allows minors to receive reconstructive genital surgery. It allows minors to receive hormone therapy. The law prohibits Minnesota officials or the courts for complying with child removal requests or extraditions or subpoenas related to a child's sex change procedures. So if it's a crime to do that, you puberty blockers or child sex surgery in the state of Montana or in the state of North Dakota next door to Minnesota, and a 14-year-old jumps across the border, he or she will receive those kinds of services, and the courts or law enforcement are blocked by law from cooperating and bringing the child back to their parents. Gives courts temporary emergency jurisdiction if a child comes to Minnesota from another state where those procedures are illegal. Again, we're talking about if a child comes to that state. So this gives you an idea of just how radical this guy is. Signs a sanctuary law for the purpose of allowing and enabling child sex surgeries in Minnesota in defiance of parental wishes and the law of the state the child lived in. In other words, come here, we'll do it for you. And requiring that fifth grade boys' bathrooms stock tampons. That is how radical this guy is. This is the guy who said, you know, not 10 years ago, but 2 months ago, that one man's socialism is another man's neighborliness, which is not true, by the way. Neighborliness does not involve the government. Socialism is nothing but the government. You would think he would know that, but gives you an idea of just how out there this guy. Well, that public nuisance in Seattle called the Belltown Hellcat driver. He's out racing his engine, making a nuisance of himself, live streaming it all for his growing list of social media followers. Is back in custody. Here's the latest. He's got more than just driving infractions on his record.
For the second time in less than a month, a judge has ordered the driver of the Belltown Hellcat to jail. Guards took Miles Hudson into custody following a hearing this morning on two reckless driving charges. Hudson is accused of disturbing people in Seattle by racing his modified sports car up and down the street. He was previously jailed in late July. As part of the terms of his release, he was ordered not to post on social media or drive his car. Hudson was jailed today for violating those terms. He's now being held on $15,000 bond.
Yeah. You really think this guy is going to comply with the law? He's going out of his way not to comply with the law. He thinks the courts are just a stage to continue his performative art. Okay, so either he's going to find out that ain't true or they're going to blink. Let's hope that they don't blink and that he finds out. No, when you're in court, it really is a serious matter.
I have a vision. He should be in a parade next year and just show everybody how loud that car is going down Fourth Avenue. Late torchlight, maybe.
If it is guilty, that should be his punishment. No more car. Belltown
exhaust, you
Hellcat,
sit
there. Doesn't belong to you no more. All right. When we come back, our senior sports correspondent on the John Carlson Show, Matthew Carlson, joining us, summing up the Olympic Games and more. A busy day ahead on the Commute with Carlson. Before we get there, I don't know if you guys ever came across Charles R. Cross, the music writer.
I have, right, and right. I noticed this story, and it was in my show notes for today as well.
Mm-hmm. Charles R. Cross, known to most people who knew him as Charlie Cross, was a journalist But his specialty, his angle, was music. And he launched and formerly owned the Rocket Entertainment magazine. And he's written a bevy of books, all of them critically acclaimed, on major legendary figures in rock music. He died in his sleep at the age of 67.
Really young, yeah.
And I note this, and it was very saddened by it. I went to college with Charlie Cross.
Did you really?
Yeah. I was at the UW when he was writing for The Daily, and John Keister was writing at that time
Almost
for
live.
The Daily,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And was a much more serious guy, by the way. And I was writing letters to the editor of The Daily because I was a very serious guy. I was head of students for Reagan and was a frequent critic of the UW Daily, eventually launching a with several students right after I graduated, helped to launch a alternative publication to The Daily for several years called The Spectator. But anyway, Charlie Cross, launched The Rocket when I was at Cairo TV doing news commentary, and he became a nationally respected figure. Rolling Stone wrote, published his obit.
And The Rocket Report helped break a lot of bands that went on to become very famous beyond Seattle. But bands like Nirvana, like Pearl Jam, bands like Alice in Chains, Soundgarden.
Yeah, the
amongst others.
The grunge sound. And so here's the interesting part about this. When I was in school with him, Charlie, his politics were left the way you would expect a music, rock music critic's politics to flow in that direction. But he was obsessed at the time with Bruce Springsteen. Now, Bruce Springsteen had a hit album that a lot of people thought had gotten way too much publicity. You know, it was on the cover of Time and Newsweek in the same week, back when those magazines really mattered a lot more than they do today. And he was saying, no, you guys don't know the half of it. This guy is going to be a major influence on music and American culture for years to come. And he actually had a every 2 week little leaflet called Backstreets, that he published. Well, he was right. Springsteen.
Sure was.
Several years later, comes Born in the USA and several others. The River came out, I think, in 1980. And then in the late 80s, early 90s, he started talking about this band called Nirvana, which just appeared to be this really heavy, depressing sound from these three sullen, always, looking askance, never smiling guys named Kurt Cobain, Dave Grohl, and... Oh, the drummer, Kurt Novoselic.
Chris Novoselic, but yeah.
Chris Novoselic was the bass
Grohl
player.
Grohl
played the drums, and lead singer was Kurt Cobain. Anyway, he was right about Nirvana. He said they were going to not just be a hit group. He said they're going to change music. They're popularizing this entire type of new music called grunge.
Central Tavern, Pioneer Square, where it all began. And Charles Cross did a biography of Kurt Cobain.
Yes, he did.
Everybody remembers that.
And he did a great biography of Jimi Hendrix and one of Heart. So I'm not surprised that you and he, met up several times, given your own background in rock music. But I've just, you know, it's sad to see someone who was a classmate, someone who you knew when you were a student out there on campus.
Just can't beat local connection when it comes to radio and stories like this.
In his writings, he did superlative work. I mean, the Rocket Report was something as a teenager growing up in University Place. I went to the Tower Records, and if I had money to buy tapes, records, discs, what have you, I was always grabbing a Rocket Report on the way out the door because it was free. Well, and then you'd learn about new music in the Rocket Report.
The thing about it, too, think about with all the internet and all the connection we have now. In radio, in music radio, we didn't have the internet. So it was things like the Rocket, like, you know, whatever it was. We were on the street, had people saying, get the latest, we got to see what's going on downtown, who's coming to town. Okay, somebody get a hold of Charles. Charles Cross, see what he can say and share on radio.
And we've had him on the show, I think, just maybe once, perhaps twice.
Yeah, I remember booking him once with you because I had booked Charles Cross on previous radio shows I've produced here in town. Mm-hmm. And he was always accessible. He was always willing to speak in interviews. I always appreciated that as a show producer because he was willing to take time for interviews and share what he knew about the things that he was writing about, the subjects he wrote on.
Rest in peace, Charles R. Cross. Died in his sleep at the age of 67. All we're told is natural causes. All right. The U.S. Olympics has wrapped up. And I watched a little of the Olympics coverage and followed it as closely as I could. But someone who followed it much more than I was our senior sports correspondent, Matthew Carlson.
I was sitting with Matthew, we were watching TV. You said, hey, Matthew, what do you see? Be their faces, do you know their names? Hey, hey, Matthew, what do you see?
Yeah, Matthew knows their names. Anyway, with the Summer Games now behind us, ladies and gentlemen, a couple of things to keep in mind. The U.S. Easily outpaced any other nation, had 126 overall medals. They tied China for the most gold medals, but they had the U.S. had 44 silvers, China had 27. There have been, I believe, 28 Summer Olympics going back to 1904, and Team USA has won the most medals at 19 of those 28. Not only that, but are you ready for this? According to the Washington Post, 40% of the 600 U.S. athletes at this year's Olympics, are you ready for this? 40% of our athletic team won a medal. 40% of our team medaled. Wow. All right. With that said, senior sports correspondent for the John Carlson Show, Matthew Carlson, welcome to 570 KVI this morning. How are you?
That's pretty good to hit 400 as an Olympic team coming back with some medal. That's pretty remarkable. I'm doing great, Dad. Good to talk to you.
All right.
Long time no see.
Yeah. I think a day or two. But anyway, yeah. Let me ask you, put it in context the way they always do. How does this Summer Games rank?
For the United States, this was one of the best Summer Olympics in the history of the modern Olympics, and that's not putting it lightly. The United States won the most medals that they ever have in an Olympics hosted outside the borders of the United States. The only two Olympics they won more at were, I believe it's 1908, St. Louis, either 08 or 04, and then 84, actually.
Oh, yeah. I remember that one.
Which was just a huge, I wasn't there, but it was just a huge victory for this country. We just dominated.
Yeah, though the 84 games... I've often said the 80s were one of my favorite decade, and one of the reasons why was the summer games in 84 in L.A. were just glorious. Yes. Peter Ueberroth.
Carl Lewis. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and just and they will be back there in 2028, in the next four years,
yes,
in Los Angeles. They'll be making a return. But the United States, from a medal perspective, just dominated, like you said, 126 medals, tied for the most golds, most silvers by far, most bronzes by far. China behind with 91 total medals, so over 30 behind.
Yeah.
And then the UK with 65. Host nation France was very strong in this Olympics with 64. And the Olympics largely were a victory for Paris, too. Several outstanding storylines, great instances of perseverance and upsets. The United States just had a wonderful Olympic Games, and it was a great opportunity for the country to be inspired and to get behind these incredible athletes.
So give our listeners, we got about 5 minutes, give our listeners five highlights of the summer games in case they were only watched sporadically, or maybe you didn't watch at all but needed to know the most significant things that happened as you see it.
Absolutely. So there's several, it's hard to pick a couple, but I have picked a few for you and your listeners. The first is that Katie Ledecky, by winning four more medals, including two golds, her fourth straight 800 meter freestyle medal.
Swimming. Women's swimming.
In swimming. In women's swimming, yeah, fourth straight, which is she won her first at 15. It's unbelievable. She becomes the most decorated female Olympian of all time.
Wow.
So Michael Phelps, you know, in the pool for the men, but Katie Ledecky racks up the most hardware for the women all time. She did very well in the pool. The United States won quite a few golds in the pool on the men and women's side. They have won a gold in swimming on the men's side in every single Olympics. It took a world record performance in the 1500 meter free, but they did it. So that's one great storyline. Another one, Ryan Krauser from Boring, Oregon. I have to shout out Boring, Oregon, just outside Portland, won his third straight gold in the shot put, just dominating competition.
Oh.
His first throw actually would have won the gold. But he is from rural Oregon, went to the University of Texas. He won his third straight shot put. Scottie Scheffler in golf. I don't know how many of your listeners follow golf. But
a lot of them don't know that it's an Olympic sport now.
Yeah, an Olympic sport. Has been for a little bit, but he had a massive upset. What a year for him. He's had his first child. He's been arrested. And he's won the PGA Tour and the U.S. Open, or pardon me, the Masters and the U.S. Open.
Mm-hmm. They dropped the charges.
they did drop the charges, yes. And he takes home Olympic gold. So that was a remarkable instance as well. You know what one of my favorites was, though, Dad, was the last event, the event that gave us the gold tie with China, was women's basketball winning their eighth straight gold medal. And at the end of the game, Brittany Griner, who, you know, took a stand, did not take a stand, you know, was kneeling for the anthem, causing a lot of controversy, ended up in Russia. Having to be traded as a prisoner. Yeah. Cameras cut to her as they won the gold, and she was standing very proudly with her hand over her heart, with tears running down her face.
Oh, wow.
As
that is a nice
United
photo.
States took the gold. So, yes, a change of heart and mind for her, certainly, and pretty remarkable to see.
Okay, my highlight was two races. The 1500, which is the closest thing they have to the mile, with Cole Hocker. And coming from behind and winning a race literally at the very last moment. And we did the same thing in the 100 meters.
Yes, Noah Lyles. Yeah, by 5/10,000ths of a second. It was a great, for, particularly for track and swimming. And I know your favorite sport of gymnastics.
Yes.
The United States cleaned up as well. Simone Biles. The men won their first gymnastics in medal in several Olympics as well, thanks to a very clutch performance on the pommel horse. So
women,
a lot of
women have always outpaced the men in gymnastics. Have you noticed that? You know,
yes.
Going back to Mary Lou Retton, you know, in 84, I think it was. Women have our best women do better in international competition than our best men. Yeah. Was there a clunker for you?
There were two clunkers. The first was the Olympic sport of breakdancing.
Oh,
that
That was weird. That was strange.
Broke down. And by the way, for your listeners, I know it sounds funny. Breakdancing can be extremely athletic and extremely entertaining.
Oh yeah.
Certainly
takes a
lot
than
of
golf.
Core strength, a lot of upper body strength. Yeah, a little more than golf. Yes. But the Olympics have already announced, by the way, that it is not coming back for 2028. Literally the day after the closing ceremony, the IOC says, no more breakdancing.
Wow.
But primarily dominated by an Australian breakdancer who goes by the name of Raygun.
In the wrong way dominated.
In the wrong way. It mainly looked like she was just
90% of the publicity goes to someone who looks like someone dancing at a local club and not doing very well. Yeah. Okay. We'll end it there. Matthew Carlson, thanks ever so much. Our senior sports correspondent on the John Carlson Show.
All right. A pleasure. Love you, Dad. Take care.
All right. Love you, son. Thanks very much. 21 minutes after 8 o'clock. Philip J. around the corner with the social media from Social. Philip J. Vandervoort III, what are you hearing in the social media world when it comes to socialism from socialists?
Well, it's socialism light today, I guess. It involves a quote unquote socialist, the Seattle Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, but she's talking fashion, which you wouldn't ordinarily expect, right?
Hmm.
Fashion seems like it comes back to that whole concept of capitalism, supply and demand, and market forces. The social media sweep, sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. But it all starts with Tim Walz, the candidate for vice president, coming up on the Democratic Party ticket. And a fashion writer named Derek Guy, menswear writer, editor at Put This On, bylines at the New York Times, Washington Post, Financial Times, Esquire, is writing about Tim Walz, saying, Walz is interesting because he wears things like Carhartt utility pants, L.L. Bean barn coats, Filson Mackinaws, and Red Wing work boots. And Filson is a Seattle company.
Yep.
And they make a lot of great stuff. It's really durable. It's high end.
Is that you or her talking right now?
That's me. I have a couple of Filson things.
Okay.
Although I had to go stand in line in the dark in the middle of the night to buy them at whatever one of their annual discount sales was. I didn't get to buy it off the rack at the retail price. But that being said, I have a couple of Filson items. Very happy with them. Really nice stuff. Pramila Jayapal then picked up on what this fashion guy is writing and adds, importantly, at Tim Underbar Walz, jacket is made by Seattle-based Filson, which employs at UFCW 3000 immigrant workers. So Pramila Jayapal not missing out on a chance.
How about that? Tim Walz has a sanctuary jacket.
Just not missing out on a chance to plug the union's work.
But also, you know, he can wear whatever costume he wants. It ain't going to work.
Yeah.
It's not going to mask his politics, which even he has said are progressive, as in progressive left wing.
Yeah.
It was he who said that one man's socialism is another man's neighborliness,
which is just a
truly inane thing to say. And his agenda, his stands on issues are like the governors of Oregon, Washington, California, not the Midwest.
And then I'll pick up and close out on one other item that relates to what you and Matthew were just talking about with the Olympics moments. U.S. women's basketball team wins a gold medal. Brittany Griner, the WNBA player, held for over a year in, or was it about a year, roughly, in Russia by Vladimir Putin's regime. And the picture has been circulating on social media of Brittany Griner at the flag ceremony, the medal ceremony, where she stands. She's got a hand over her heart. She's got the gold medal around her neck, and she's visibly crying at the national anthem and the medal ceremony. Outkick is a sports website that says your antidote to the mainstream sports media. So I'm guessing that's the ESPN-type mainstream sports media. Outkick posts the picture of Brittany Griner, says, went from kneeling for the national anthem to standing proud with tears streaming down Brittany Griner's face. And then one of the conservative political columnists at the Boston Globe, Jeff Jacoby, he picked up on this and pointed out something that I thought was both instructive and very respectful. He went, he wrote, from suffering comes wisdom, and from painful experience comes growth. Much respect to Brittany Griner.
Good.
And that's kind of what you and Matthew were talking about a little bit in the last segment.
Yeah, good. No, that was a wonderful moment, wonderful American moment. And I hope a lot of other athletes who have knelt in the past, from high school on to the pros, who...
It won't be taken for granted anymore.
Who never saw a loss of their freedom for a year in another country. I hope they watched her at that awards ceremony and did some serious thinking about, wow, what has she learned that I still haven't learned? There's what you call a wonderful teaching moment there. Brittany Griner, with her hand over her heart, weeping after winning gold at the Olympics, representing the United States. 31 minutes after 8 o'clock, the commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KPL.
Having you back, John, and Phil in charge yesterday, and I get to co-produce and step up to the producer chair. We covered so many things yesterday. And having Matt on, giving the recap of the Olympics, a lot of people now going through withdrawal. Now we got Seahawks preseason. They're off to a good start. The win Saturday in L.A. While you were gone, Mariners on ESPN Sunday Night Baseball against the Mets. That's been a first in 20 years. We got to see that.
Yeah, plus we won.
And yeah, okay. So here's another thing we need to bring up here.
It's the Mets. They're awful.
Swept them.
But
Ari Hoffman swept them. Not too late. You can make your kids happier in life if you convert them to Seattle Mariners fans, Ari Hoffman.
And speaking of kids and baseball, here we go. And the freedom we have here, being local, John, getting through the neighborhood here with the combination of sources that Phil has, you have, and myself. Time for Little League World Series. And Phil, I got to make a correction because a couple listeners sent me notes on this.
We chatted about this a bit yesterday.
Yeah, and it's what happened, Little League team here, Puyallup. South Hill Little League team beating West Valley Little League of Idaho 13-7 last week. So, South Hill Little League team headed for the Little League World Series. Yesterday we were talking how many teams are involved with this. It's 6,000 teams, Phil.
Across the nation.
Across the nation. And we were thinking all the teams, if you included Japan or whatever, 10 different regions. First game for this Little League team, our good friends there in Puyallup at South Hill. They got a bye in their first game. Tomorrow, we've got to see who wins the Southeast and the Midwest. And then Friday, it'll be South Hill Puyallup against the winner of that game tomorrow. 3 p.m. Friday, ESPN, if you want to watch the kids of Puyallup in the Little League World Series.
From Puyallup, this is wonderful.
Field of Dreams type stuff.
Oh, yeah. Good stuff.
So are they in Williamsport?
Yeah.
Beautiful. Yeah. That's where they play all the major Little League World Series.
I have to keep an eye on that for Friday, 3 p.m.
That's going to be terrific. Yes. No, we have had several listeners who have called to tell us. So thank you, by the way, for doing so. And I also got this. Can you give us an accurate description on what happened late on August 9th regarding the initiatives that the suit the Washington State Supreme Court heard? Here is what happened. I've never seen anything quite like this in Washington State in all my years being involved in media and politics. There is a very well-funded left-wing organization that is called Defend Washington, and they are against all the initiatives. Nothing wrong with that. Except this organization, which says it exists to protect democracy, was trying to prevent people from being able to vote on these initiatives, which doesn't sound like democracy to me. They filed a suit saying that the method they used to validate signatures was illegal, unconstitutional, and therefore none of the initiatives are valid and all should be tossed from the ballot.
So a technicality or something like that, right? What they're hanging their hat on?
Anyway, they've been using this method, by and large, for decades. Okay, so there was nothing new this year that they were doing. Secondly, none of these initiatives just barely got over the finish line. They all finished with a healthy majority of oversignatures to account for the occasional signature that is not legally submitted. You know, the person's name doesn't match their residence or, you know, what have you. And that's not the unusual part. The unusual part is that the Attorney General's office very quietly managed this lawsuit without informing the news media, without informing the Let's Go Washington organization, letsgowa.com. They didn't alert the public either. In other words, they tried to keep everyone in the dark while they were dealing with this lawsuit that would drive these initiatives off the ballot. Again, that it's just strange. It's just weird. But they were definitely not only keeping the public in the dark, they were keeping the parties in the dark. And then there came from Bob Ferguson, you know, the typical, you know, reptilian response. What do you mean this isn't public information? Of course it's public information. Anyone could see it. All you have to do is search the court dockets to see that it was going to be on, it was going to be heard. How many people search the state Supreme Court docket to find out what's going on in the judiciary?
Yeah, and even when you do search it, all it kicks out is name of plaintiff, name of defendant, and then that there might be a time and a place where this hearing is going on. It explains nothing about, hey, the fate of four statewide initiatives are hanging in the balance here. It won't say anything about that. It'll just say the name of the plaintiff and the name of the defendant.
So
kind of disingenuous for him to
exactly
rely on that.
And we had Brian Haywood on at 7:05, and as he put it, he says, Bob Ferguson, the kind of guy who will send out a press release if the sun's coming up.
Also true.
For some reason, didn't put out any press attention, even though this suit has been in the machinery of the judiciary for months. That's what you expect, quite frankly. That's what you expect a slimy lawyer to say. What are you talking about? It's right there in the court document and the court docket. Why should I be expected to publicize this case? Yeah. Why should I expect to have something on our website? Why should I expect to notify the parties? All they need to do is search the docket.
And setting Ferguson's answer aside, if the plaintiffs were trying to bring this suit, the supporters like who's the Seattle guy? Hanauer. Nick Hanauer.
Nick Hanauer.
If they're so proud about, hey, we really need to put a check and balance on these initiatives, don't you think that they'd want to alert the public that this is something that they're doing? But obviously they didn't want to call any attention to what they were doing either.
And that's what I think was going on here.
Yeah.
Because Nick Hanauer is a Bob Ferguson donor.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's certainly not a Dave Reichert donor, and he's certainly not a Let's Go Washington donor.
Several of the people who financially underwrite the organization that filed this suit are Bob Ferguson donors.
Yeah, but if you
it is not a stretch to assume that Hanauer or one of the other funders of both Ferguson and this lawsuit said, look, we really want a lot of attention for this.
Yeah. If they felt strongly enough about it, they'd accept and they'd want to promote what they were doing. But they clearly didn't.
We understand you've got a job to do, but nothing says you have to publicize this.
Yeah. We had listener on the text line in the 7 o'clock hour when you were talking to Brian Haywood about this that texted and asked, John, what about any involvement by Secretary of State Steve Hobbs' office in concealing Ferguson's anti-initiative lawsuit? Is there anything that Hobbs may have known about this?
Well, the real outrage should be trained on the Attorney General. But, of course, the Secretary of State's office was informed since they're the ones being sued.
Yeah.
Okay.
For approving these initiatives, right?
So, as a courtesy, the Secretary of State's office could have notified Let's Go Washington. But I'm assuming that Steve Hobbs thought the Attorney General was doing it, since, after all, it's their initiatives. I mean, the character test for the Secretary of State's office was, you know, are they going to do signature verification for these initiatives? Are they going to be on the level, or are they going to play games? Because the left wanted them to play games. And you know what? The Secretary of State's office didn't play games. They played it down the middle. They were honorable and honest and straightforward in signature verification. And they were, you know, civil, not hostile. They were accommodating to the degree that they could be. And so they were playing it the way you're supposed to play it. If you're being objective, and keep in mind, there aren't a lot of people in Olympia who are objective, fair-minded, and even-handed. So I'm guessing that the Secretary of State's office didn't inform Brian Haywood and Let's Go Washington about these lawsuits, because he assumed that if the Attorney General was notifying him, of course he'd be notifying Brian Haywood as well. No, he wanted this kept quiet. And I think he was keeping it quiet on behalf of the people launching the lawsuit, because they're political allies of him. The only good news here is that the ridiculous lawsuits were swept aside by the state Supreme Court, which itself has bias problems, but not this time. It was 7-0, or 9-0. It was unanimous. Clock. You know, young Matthew and I didn't have time to cover all the Olympics news that would be of interest to KVI listeners, because Washington sets a record for 13 total medals at the Paris Olympics. Again, if the University of Washington were a nation unto itself, it would have been tied for 16th in the total medal count. How about that? Current and former Huskies won 13 total medals at the games, the most in school history. 11 Husky rowers won medals in the Paris Regatta, setting a program record that had stood since 1936, when the boys in the boat of movie and book fame won 9. Anyway, those 11 medals were one away from the school best of 12 set in 1936 and again in 1984. But we cleared that bar when Australia's Sammy Whitcomb won a bronze medal and Team USA's Kelsey Plum won gold to bring the Huskies to a lucky 13 medals. 2 gold, 2 silver, 9 bronze medals. That included British rower Jacob Dawson winning gold, again, UW student. It included several other rowers, including Logan Ulrich and Gert J. Van Doom. It was just a wonderful Olympics, not just for America, but for the University of Washington Huskies. They sent 29 total athletes across 12 different countries in 5 different sports. So congratulations, UW Huskies, doing okay at this Olympic Games. Hey, get out there. Enjoy this day. Let's talk again tomorrow because a lot is going on. Democratic convention underway.